On the line now, I have outgoing CEO of Barnardos, Fergus Findlay. Good afternoon, Fergus. How are you?
How are you doing? Not too bad. How are you?
Okay. I imagine...
I'm glad you played the traffic, Wilfried.
Okay. Yeah, mine too. I'm sure you must have mixed feelings over the years, the way things have sort of, I'll use the word, deteriorated in services and stuff like that.
Well, I do have mixed feelings. I mean, I'm retiring from Barnardos next week, and I've been working in Barnardos for 13 years. And if you had told me the day I started that when I was leaving Barnardos, there'd be more than nearly 4,000 children homeless in Ireland, I'd have just said you were bonkers, that couldn't possibly happen in a civilized country. But it has. We haven't made the changes that we have needed to make in policy terms. We haven't given children the priority that they should have. So yes, I certainly do have mixed feelings, no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm very, very proud of the fact we've grown in Barnardos with the number of children and families we reach every year, that we've done everything we can do. We've had a huge amount of support from people all around Ireland, and we've tried to put that to good use. But still, there are thousands of children who need support and aren't getting.
And with the report that was launched there back in the early part of the month, are you anyway optimistic that things are going to get better, do you think? Or do you think that the politicians have sort of lost contact with what's happening on the ground?
I think there's an element of that, for sure. I mean, I don't think children get the priority that they deserve. And I would worry that we're now heading into a budgetary cycle and a political cycle in which, you know, there's going to be a general election in the next 12 months in all probability, and there's going to be huge pressure on politicians to, cut taxes and spend money in all sorts of ways that won't make life better for children. At the same time, we seem to be obsessed in Ireland with all sorts of, you know, we're committed to investing in all sorts of bright, shiny, new, modern things. Billions and billions of euro on metro lines and things of that sort, where a tiny fraction of that kind of money would make an enormous difference in the lives of children. So we keep campaigning and we keep arguing and we keep shouting from the rooftops, but I do want political priorities to change.
Mm-hmm. And all the agencies, as well as Barnardos, are screaming at them as well about all the things that is going on. As you said yourself, I mean, they've been talking about things that cost millions, billions. That's the way people talk these days. There's no thousands anymore.
It's crazy
stuff. But do you think that, for instance, like that they think about the future of the children? As you said, there's 4,000 children in accommodation now that they shouldn't be in. And it's what the strain and the mental health of these children and what they will come out as. And prevention is always the better cure.
It's always the better cure. And what's more, it costs a fraction. It costs more than $500,000 a year to keep a child in secure care. Now, there are a small number of children in secure care in Ireland. And the child would only be in secure care if they're at risk, a risk to themselves or a risk to others. But it's still $500,000 per child. It costs about $6,000 a year to provide a child with a really good quality preventative program that will enable them to grow and develop and get the most out of their schooling. It always seemed to me to be a bit of a no-brainer that we should be investing more in prevention and early intervention. There are experts all over the world, and they're not experts in childhood development. They're experts in things like value for money, cost-benefit analysis, and so on. And all of them will say to you, all of them, without exception, will say to you, that if you invest money in young children, you get a much better economic return from it. You save an enormous amount of money on welfare dependency, on prison costs, on policing costs, and so on. I mean, the basic rule, I think, is that the young person who's doing his junior cert or her junior cert or their leaving cert is never the young person who's terrorizing the neighborhood. Yeah. or falling foul of the guards. And that's why it boggles my mind sometimes that we invest so little in Ireland in, for example, in preschool education. We have a minister now who's trying to ramp up the investment in preschool education, but until then we were the lowest in the OECD when it came to preschool education investment. And the payoff, never mind for a moment, if you like, the benefits to children, but the payoff to society. We need to raise the people who'll pay our pensions, mm-hmm. And who look after us in our old age, and we need them to be proud and independent and able to earn a decent living and able to maintain sustained relationships and so on. If we insist on leaving kids without those kinds of supports in disadvantaged communities that have been completely overlooked, then we're kind of reaping a bit of a whirlwind, I think.
Mm-hmm. As you said yourself there, the way things are here and how we're lacking in things, but it seems to be a worldwide phenomenon across the world, homelessness and but how big is the deficit here compared to other European countries? With services, I mean.
I can give you a couple of examples. I mean, if you lived in Newry, or you lived in Cardiff, or you lived in one of the London boroughs, and you were taking your kids to school for the first time, you would discover that everything they needed to get the most out of their schooling was there waiting for them. Their books, their workbooks, all of that material, every bit of material. And in fact, in those jurisdictions, it's mandated by law that they must be supplied as part of a child's education. We know what it costs to start a child in education in Ireland. And we're probably the most expensive country in Europe to start a child in education in. And that cost doesn't get any smaller. Mm-hmm. And of course, the irony is we're one of the few countries in Europe where children have a constitutional right to a free primary education. But we're still one of the most expensive when it comes to primary education. So we don't compare well internationally. Okay. Under most of these headings at all.
Yeah, it seems to be lots of contradictions there, because lots of things that are happening, everyone's talking about how well we're doing as a country, one of the richest countries in Europe at the moment,
nearly
full employment, and still it doesn't reflect in the services that we have, especially for children.
Especially for children. And I mean, I don't want to exaggerate this, and I don't want to be accused of scaremongering. I mean, for maybe 85-87% of our children, Ireland is an exciting place. I mean, it's a place where they do have opportunity and they do have a chance to reach their full potential. But for that small number of children, and the official figures would suggest it's about 1 in 9 of our children, that small number of children, not only do they not have an exciting country to live in, they have a country in which they go hungry, in which they go undernourished, in which the cold in the winter. What kind of drives me mad in a way is if the numbers are that small, it's only 1 in 9, then it ought to be a fixable problem in a country, as you say, that, you know, boasts about being one of the richest countries in the world. We've made a very, very strong recovery from the disaster that befell us. We've more people at work than we did at the height of the Celtic Tiger. And still we can't look after children who are vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And will there be sort of propositions put into, with the budget coming up the way it is, could deal with more funding towards Barnardos and other agencies as well, but especially to Barnardos and the great work that they do? Are you optimistic about that?
Well, we get some funding from the state now. When the recession started, and we're not alone in this, every organisation in the community and voluntary sector, almost without exception, started to see cuts in state funding. And over the years of the recession, our funding was cut by about 20%. And we have argued that that should be restored. There's a kind of an anomaly in Ireland where the public service, for example, was significantly cut. And government has recognised that they have a kind of a... they owe a debt to public servants, to teachers and guards and nurses and so on. And they're going through a process at the moment of ensuring that they get pay increases and all that kind of thing. in the community and voluntary sector, they have made no such recognition. There's been no discussion at all about restoring any of the funding to the community and voluntary sector. And it applies right across the board. It's not just Bernardo's. It applies to, you know, all of the organisations that work in this area where we've taken cuts. And there's a kind of a supposition that if you work in the community and voluntary sector, you can do more with less. And that's the message that we've got over the years. And I think the time is coming, to be perfectly honest, where the community and voluntary sector as a whole has to say to government, hang on a second, hang on a second. We can't keep going at this level. Nobody who works in Bernardo's has had a pay increase for 7 or 8 years, and that's not what we're crying out for. We're not crying out for pay increases. We're crying out for the resources to work with children and families. But it's a reality, you know. There are 400 people who work in Bernardo's, and they have mortgages and they have families to raise as well as everybody else.
Yeah, do you think that, I mean, the Irish are well known, reading lots of things during the week, well known for their per capita, for their generosity, and do you think the government in some ways rely on that generosity and the volunteership, indeed, of ordinary people who keep these places up?
The government does. The government does. And there's no doubt about the generosity of the Irish people. I encounter it every working day, and you know, we wouldn't have survived without it. And again, as I say, that doesn't just apply to us. I know I work very closely with a lot of other organisations who depend very heavily, and I find it galling that, you know, the government can kind of look you in the eye and say, well, you know, it's more volunteers we need. Mm-hmm. I mean, we work with a lot of volunteers, and I'm immensely grateful to the volunteers that we work with, and they help us in all sorts of ways. But if you break your arm and you're brought into hospital and somebody says to you, well, there's no doctor available, but I have a volunteer here who'd like to help you fix your arm, you think you'd say, I'll go to the doctor, thanks. Mm-hmm. And exactly the same thing is true if you have a traumatised child who needs an awful lot of help and support to rebuild his or her confidence, to help build his or her resilience, to try and put what are very often damaged lives back together. It needs professional skill. It needs time. It needs energy. It needs patience. It needs dedication. And the best volunteers in the world, unless they have all the training that is necessary, can't do that. Mm-hmm. Volunteers help others to do it. But you have to have professional staff. And if you have professional staff, you have to pay them decent salaries.
Indeed. Just to ask you a question, it may seem a bit out of kilter, but as regards the ripple effect with the families, I mean, you look after children, all right, but surely that has, if children are not being looked after and they can't be looked after by the family, the parents and that, because of lack of resources, it must reflect through the whole family, so it has an effect on the full family.
Of course it does, Noel. I mean, like, we try as hard as we possibly can not to work with the child without working with the family. And I mean, the truth is, like, you know, I'm a long time doing this now. I've never met a mum or a dad who doesn't love their children and doesn't want the best for their children. Mm-hmm. But I have met hundreds of mums and dads whose own lives are out of control, who find it almost impossible to cope with, you know, the things that life throws at them. I've met hundreds of mums and dads who struggle with mental health, with depression, with anxiety, with other consequences of poverty. I've met hundreds of mums and dads who, you know, whose lives are affected by drugs or alcohol or whatever. And it is really, really difficult, no matter how much you love your children, to be an effective parent in those kind of situations. And that's part of, it's a very, very significant part of what we do, is helping mums and dads to put their lives back together in ways that enable them to be the kind of parents they want to be. You know, when we say last year we worked with 15,000 children and families, we mean that. We don't mean we worked only with 15,000 children. We worked with their families too. And we work alongside people to help them through those kinds of struggles, because, I mean, I know with my hand on my heart that if a child is spending his or her morning in a Bernardo's project, an early years project, let's say, they're going to have a wonderful experience of childhood for that morning and for the 5 mornings a week that they're with us. But that can be beaten out of them by life, by tea time. Okay. You know, we can't take all the adversity out of children's lives. Only parents and only families that are functioning as well as they can function will do that. I have a kind of a saying, if you'll pardon me for rambling on a bit.
Go on.
And you meet them all the time. Children who are born into poverty, they can make it in life. There's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't make it in life. But it's a little bit more of a struggle,
mm-hmm.
a little bit of an uphill climb. If they're born into poverty in a family where there's dysfunction of one kind or another for a whole variety of reasons, often outside the family's control, that uphill struggle becomes like climbing Kilimanjaro. And if those circumstances exist, and at the same time they live in communities of disadvantage, of deep-rooted and chronic disadvantage, and we all know where they are.
Mm-hmm. And when you're talking...
Kilimanjaro becomes Everest.
Okay. So, when you're talking about... fixing the problem and trying to get it sorted and financial way, we're really literally talking about thousands. We're not talking about the way others talk about millions and billions. We're talking about thousands. And where you were talking about difficulties in the families, do you think it's a bit of a catch-22 as well because of the difficulty of the parents with the children that causes them to get solace somewhere else?
Life can be a vicious circle, and we all know that. We all have our moments when we're having real difficulty coping, and we perhaps turn to substances or alcohol or whatever it is to help us to cope better, and we discover very, very quickly that life has got worse, not better. Or we turn to if we're not able to cope with some of the demands of life, we might turn to an illegal money lender, and mm-hmm. God knows we've worked with families who've had to do that as well. And they solve the problem today, and they multiply the problem tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there are vicious circles that people get trapped in, it's our job when we can and where we can to try and help them break out of them.
Okay, well, can I be a little bit cheeky with you now, Fergus? You were involved in politics in another life there. Do you think when they talk about new politics, how does that make you feel? And have politicians changed and their priorities seem to change over the years since you were involved with them? Or is it just the same old?
When I was involved in politics, I had a few priorities. And I tried to focus on those priorities. I was very heavily involved, for example, in issues around disability and intellectual disability. And I'm not sure if we made the progress that we needed to make. In fact, I know we didn't make the progress we needed to make. I kind of see politics now as drifting somewhat. I don't see it as being focused on priorities. I don't think there's any problem that this country has that can't be fixed with real focus and determination. And the best politicians I've known in my lifetime are those that have a particular focus. People, the politicians who kind of are absolutely determined to build houses or end polio or eradicate TB. The politicians who have come into office with a singular focus and a particular focus. Two politicians, and they don't get enough credit at all, both of whom devised very significant plans to improve services for people with intellectual disabilities. Mm-hmm. One was Brian Cowan when he was Minister of Health. One was Brendan Howland when he was Minister of Health. When Michael Noonan was Minister for Health, he had a very, very strong focus on heart treatment for cardiac treatment. And he made a huge amount of progress in that mm-hmm. area. And nobody remembers those things. Do you know what I mean? Nobody,
yes, yeah.
They make in other areas that are remembered.
I think a lot of the uncertainty as well is, and the shakiness is the change, and there's so many elections over the years, and people not changing in their jobs, not long enough in it, and maybe lose interest because they know they're not going to be long in it, and that sort of carry on. And maybe I'm making excuses for them now, but I think you're right there. Can I ask you one last cheeky question before you go? What's next for you, Fergus?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Okay.
I wish I did. I was supposed to retire from Barnardos years ago, and they asked me to stay on at the time, and I agreed with a heart and a half because I love the organisation.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember thinking at least this gives me 3 years to prepare, and you'll never guess, the 3 years went by in a flash, and I'm about as unprepared now as I was 3 years ago. So something will happen, I've no doubt. I'm going to write, and I'm going to study, and I'm going to do various things. I'm going to find a dog to walk, and I'm going to spend an awful lot more time with my grandchildren. But I also want to, you know, find something useful to do.
Okay.
And my wife wants me to find something useful to do as well.
Keep you out of the house. It's been a great pleasure talking to you, Fergus, and congratulations on all the great work you've done in the past. And as I say, I'm sure you're going to be doing some great work in the future. Happy retirement and keep well, Fergus. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And that's the outgoing CEO of Bernardo's, Fergus Finley. Great man indeed, and some great work done over the years. And when he was talking there about the time going so fast, as I always say, the older you get, the quicker it goes.